Welcome to the podcast, Byzantium and Friends. I'm Anthony, your host, and I'm very happy that you tuned in again. I think it is safe to say that about 100 years ago, Western European scholarship on what had very recently been renamed Byzantium was mired in fantasy and delusion. Prevalent paradigms included race theory, French decadence theory, Orientalism, the newly discovered imperial idea, which is a theological, metaphysical interpretation of a historical society. It was probably the low point in hundreds of years of interest in the Eastern Roman Empire. The late 19th and early 20th centuries were, in my view, the low point in terms of how it was interpreted. In my study of this period, I was surprised to see what a positive and salutary role Russian scholars played in pulling the field back from the brink of such fantasies. I'm referring in particular to people like Ostrogorsky and Vasiliev and others who had no commitment to these Western ideological fantasies, but who also, in fleeing the Bolshevik Revolution or the Soviet Union, did not bring with them any particular, you know, Russian ideological fixations, at least none that are visible on the surface of their works. And it is interesting that the main textbooks for studying Byzantine history in the 20th century came from, you know, those two men and others. But also later, during the Soviet Union, a major impact on Western scholarship was played by Alexander Kazhdan, who was a refugee from the Soviet Union. There's this kind of pattern of excellent Russian scholars who leave Russia, not under the best circumstances. And there's a group who have left now in the current, during the war and current circumstances in Russia. Having said that, among non-experts, Russian culture and especially political ideology are prone to generating their own fantasies about Byzantium and very ideologically motivated uses of it to promote current projects. There's nothing surprising about this. It is exactly what you would expect from any country, any modern nation, especially one with great power aspirations, in facing a part of the past that is somehow relevant to its own sort of cultural, religious, imperial, you know, DNA, and it seeks to recast it either in its own image or as a warning for itself. Just think of, you know, the complex relationship between the United States and the, quote, fall of the Roman Empire, which generates such an enormous amount of nonsense, especially online. And it is also online that you will find the most avid champions of the idea of sort of imperial slash modern Russia as a kind of heir or continuation of Byzantium, the third Rome model, and all of that. In reality, there's very little evidence of a closer connection between imperial Russia and Byzantium than there was between France and Byzantium. All Christian countries reuse the same kinds of motifs or turn to the Eastern Empire in part to find, you know, talking points and accessories that they need in the present. But I don't think there was a very much closer connection between Russia and Byzantium. Even on the point of orthodoxy, which sometimes would be stressed more, of course, but for the most part, Byzantium was seen as a warning case, you know, what goes wrong because of the last-minute union with the Catholic Church, so as a kind of failed orthodox state. It is, in fact, only in recent times that this imaginary construct of Byzantium as a kind of template for Russian imperialism, Orthodox fundamentalism, and so forth has really gained ground, and only in some corners of either the popular media or politically sponsored propaganda. And it is this phenomenon that we will be discussing today. My guest is Eugene Smilansky, a historian at Washington State University, and he has recently published a a brief and accessible, very clearly written book on medievalisms and Russia, The Contest for Imaginary Pasts. It was published by Arc Humanities Press just now, a few days ago, I think. And this is a book about Russia, more like contemporary Russia, but looking back to, you know, its roots sometimes in the 19th and 20th centuries, and its engagement with the medieval past and instrumental use of it. And some sections of the book deal with Byzantium from this point of view, and we focus on those. This is a very important contribution, in part because it fills out on the Russian side a discussion that is very much more developed on the Western medieval side, that is the way in which Western European countries, also the United States, have redeployed the medieval past as part of their current conversations and cultural projects. And this whole creative re-engagement with the Middle Ages often goes by the name of medievalism. And so this is Russia's medievalism. And we are going to talk in particular with its, what we might call Byzantinism, that is the kind of reinvention of Byzantium to serve contemporary ideological needs. Eugene has looked at everything from books and pamphlets to videos and exhibitions and documentaries, or documentaries in quotation marks, and political speeches and so forth. So it's a very, very well-rounded and diverse picture that he presents here of all the imaginary Byzantiums that one can encounter, traveling along the byways of current Russian popular culture. Okay, let's get to it. Thanks to medievalist.net for reposting these episodes. Here's my conversation with Eugene. Eugene, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Can you tell us first a little bit about your own core research, which I understand is somewhat different from what's in this book, and how you came to write this book?
Of course. And it is really different. I was trained as a historian of late medieval Germany. I largely focused my first book, and then I also published a collection of primary sources that focuses on religious persecution in towns and kind of intolerance and persecution in medieval Europe, largely Western Europe in general. It was one of those things that I was always interested in. I grew up in Ukraine, in Odessa, on the Black Sea coast. And I have family ties with both in both Ukraine and Russia. And so in some ways, many of the things I talk about in the book, I kind of witnessed or experienced in terms of, for example, that Byzantine documentary that we talk about how Byzantium compares to Russia, the fall of the empire. I remember seeing on TV during one of my visits to Russia back then in the kind of early 2000s. And so it was something that kind of was always a little bit in the back of my mind. And then, 2020, my first monograph was finished. It was the pandemic. I was kind of bored. I was following the news coverage of how COVID was affecting Russia. And I noticed that in one of his interviews, Vladimir Putin compared COVID to kind of the ravages of these Turkic nomads, right? The Cumans and Pechenegs. That really, as a medievalist, I was like, what is going on there? And so I wrote a short piece for the Public Medievalist, which is a great website on dealing with all kinds of manifestations of the Middle Ages in the present. So that was fun. And I was kind of thinking, maybe one day I'll do a longer piece or kind of longer exploration of this. And then about a week before Russia invaded Ukraine in February 2022, Anna Henderson of Arc Humanities Press reached out to me and suggested that they I take on this project? And I said yes, and started putting the proposal together. And then the invasion happened, and I kind of felt like, well, now I have to do it, because there's just so many kind of interesting ways in which I think the kind of current Russian political climate uses the Middle Ages, and I wanted to explore that in more detail.
I remember that claim by Putin about the Cumans and the Pechenegs, in part because, like, I work on the Cumans and the Pechenegs, and I know that you get no mileage from mentioning Cumans and Pechenegs in Western discourse. Like, so I was intrigued by what, like, what public discourse exists in a country where Cumans and Pechenegs are, like, a reference that you can meaningfully make. Anyway, we'll get to that. But can you first tell us, what are medievalisms? Because this is a sort of relatively technical term. So what spectrum of topics does research on medievalism encompass? And what is the range that you primarily cover in your book?
Yes. And that's a really, it is a term that I think to, yeah, non-specialists can be a little puzzling, because it's essentially, medievalisms are kind of examples of reception of the Middle Ages after the Middle Ages were already over. This developed over the last few decades, I would say, and it's still fairly broad, but also very kind of new field that covers really everything under the sun to some extent, because the Middle Ages have been so influential. Right, we can go from, you know, pop culture to politics to topics like nationalism and imperialism, explore the role of the Middle Ages, or kind of the invocations of the Middle Ages in discussions about race and gender, in music, you know, music videos. You know, I know there are some studies of like metal, for example, and how a lot of, you know, kind of rock music leans into kind of certain medievalisms. It's often interdisciplinary, and it often tries to, again, combine these topics as well. So, for example, you could explore video games and talk about how they might connect to ideas like, you know, nostalgia or nationalism or imperialism or white supremacy, films, and, you know, again, everything in between. My book, because, as I've mentioned, it kind of developed in the shadow of this invasion, I'm largely focusing on political medievalism. So things that affect Russian politics and have been affecting Russian politics for the last few centuries. And so, for example, I look at how Russia appropriates histories of Rus, of medieval Rus, how it claims to be the heir or have some sort of special connection to the Byzantine Empire, the way it uses medieval figures like Alexander Nevsky, for example, as symbols of this imagined perennial struggle against the West. And in the conclusion of my book, I get into topics like sacralization of violence, even some crusading rhetoric that's been that's not always present in Russian discourses. After all, it didn't really have a crusading tradition per se, but has been kind of borrowed, ironically, from the West, and is being used, the kind of sacralization of violence has been used in the recent invasion as well.
Yeah, it's important to stress that medievalism encompasses a very, very wide range of research areas. And, you know, you're focusing more on sort of appropriations for national or imperial ideologies, you know, constructions of national histories and things like that. But, you know, the other in the spectrum, it also includes, like, you know, reenactments and, you know, medievalist, you know, dress up and whatever, which it's one of these interesting areas where people who are engaged in that are also doing primary research,
right,
in order to, quote, get it right. And sometimes very important research, like about food and dress and, you know, implements and things like that. And it's one of those areas where primary research and reenactment, like medievalist reenactment, converge in this really interesting way. But anyway, so we're going to be talking more about things like national narratives and the use of the Middle Ages for imperial projects and so on. But before I talk about Russia in particular, maybe we can discuss just very briefly just some other ways in which European or Christian countries have kind of created their national histories or around the Middle Ages or drafting the Middle Ages to perform some sort of service in them. Just to give a range of the to give a sense of the spectrum of potential that exists here. And you do you have any? I mean, you've worked on medieval Germany, so you must know German case as well.
Yes, and it, again, this is I there are kind of two things I wanted to point out. One is that as you were saying just now, you know, just because I think there's also like I kind of in my book I wanted to dispel this idea that. You know, just because people are borrowing on the Middle Ages, they inevitably come up with some, you know, these very dark kind of, you know, political ideologies. No, you can certainly animate these ideologies with medieval invocations and kind of pull the Middle Ages into it. But I also have a chapter in the book that talks about how the Middle Ages was becoming a kind of space for dissent and for disagreement with official culture. So I think, you know, I always try to kind of dispel that idea of the, you know, quote unquote, dark ages that, yes. that produce like dark present, right? Yeah, and then to answer your question, yes, there's a lot of really, a lot of examples all over Europe and even in North America, for example, in North America, just since I mentioned it, we know that like in the 19th century, both before the Civil War and after the Civil War in the American South, there was this obsession with the Middle Ages. They saw, you know, the planter class especially imagined themselves as these kind of lords of the manor. Mark Twain calls it famously the Walter Scott disease, referring to the popularity of Sir Walter Scott's novels like Ivanhoe in the South. During that same time, right, again, that's kind of a high point, right, of imperialism and nationalism. We see Britain, for example, or the British Empire, using the Crusades as a kind of antecedent of the British Empire. And for example, especially in the during World War One, when Britain is fighting the Ottoman Empire in the Middle East, they really lean into this idea that they are, you know, finishing the kind of unfinished business of the Crusades, retaking Jerusalem, that sort of stuff. But of course, yes, Germany, right? We can think of like German nationalism and Wagner's The Ring Cycle. And of course, later on, a lot of medieval appropriations were used by the Third Reich, right? By the Nazis. But we can also think of Spain, for example, right? So especially during the reign of Franco, the dictatorship of Franco in Spain, history and historiography of the so-called Christian, you know, reconquest, Reconquista, gets to be used and imagined as a kind of golden age, as this glorious past, as a model for imitation, which again is very fitting for the fascist regime to do that. So there is a lot of different examples, but of course we can also think of, again, you know, collegiate Gothic, right, is a huge part of this, right? Yes. Trying to build every university. And it's actually really interesting, you know, in the area that I'm in Eastern Washington and kind of Northern Idaho, even small colleges, I've noticed, have some, you know, architectural reference to the Middle Ages, because they were, you know, they were founded and that some of the buildings were built in the early 20th century. So there, it's really fascinating just how many examples we can point to.
Well, I'm at the University of Chicago. I'm at the ground zero for that phenomenon, really.
Exactly.
And I love the fact that you started out by saying that it's not all dark. And by dark, I don't just mean the image of the Middle Ages as kind of dark ages and so forth, but just the modern use of the Middle Ages isn't always the Third Reich, right? And that they're a very flexible reference point. You mentioned Spain. And I've studied the history of Spain as I've been there many times in recent years. And it's fascinating to see how a country just switches relatively quickly from the Francoist, you know, reconquest and the Catholic king's emphasis to the more liberal Spain of the three cultures and, you know,
Convivencia, right? And yes,
exactly.
exactly.
And, you know, even in the Eastern European or Slavic or even Russian Soviet tradition, there was this whole emphasis on the Slavs, the early Slavs, as being sort of these democratic, free people who resisted imperial control and kind of,
Proto-communist, right? That was that sort of
yeah,
idea that,
exactly,
communism
anti-imperialism.
wasn't something external, we've always done it kind of
Yes,
thing, right?
and drawing that from passages in Procopius, who's one of these 6th-century authors I've studied, who does say that. I mean, he actually does say that. So it's not this. Anyway, it's fun stuff. So the Middle Ages are like all over the place, and in all kinds of different forms. They're not always sinister and dark and so forth. Okay, we're going to be talking about a specific modern tradition, so that of Russia. Well, I mean, the Soviet Union, and then Russia, which has like a number of countries, many traditions to draw from, and it has created a kind of eclectic mix from them. A parallel that I'm thinking of also is Turkey, where, you know, Erdogan had, for, I don't know if he still has this, but he had this like honor guard of soldiers that were dressed in period uniforms from like every period of what he took to be Turkish history. You know, there was a Seljuk, there was an Ottoman, there was a, I mean, there, and anyway, and some of these elements are often contradictory, you know, in the way in which right now in Russia you've got like Stalin, but also the last czars, and like, so can you tell us a little bit about how these seemingly contradictory elements are kind of jumbled together or synthesized? I mean, like, what is the common denominator that allows Russia to talk about, you know, Volodymyr and the czars and the Soviet Union?
Yeah, no, it is fascinating because in some ways, it's you, like you're saying, right? Every country wants to present itself as a continuous kind of narrative, a continuous story. In case of Russia, contemporary Russia, it had a particular problem that you alluded to, that since the fall of the Soviet Union, there was a kind of a dilemma of how do you make sense of all these changes and really dramatic changes. On one hand, you have Imperial Russia, ending with the Russian Revolution. You have the revolution itself, and then you have decades of the Soviet period that also kind of change somewhat, the focus on from a kind of internationalist communism to a more kind of national Bolshevism under Stalin. I think in the end, what they've tried to do, and this is especially I think a feature of Putin's time in power, was to emphasize continuity, and it kind of draw equally on both imperial and Soviet historiography and Soviet history, and create this idea of Russia as a thousand-year civilization that ignores everything that doesn't fit, but foregrounds certain common themes. For example, submission to the state, and this is sort of cult of the state, cult of power, cult of tradition, as opposed to individualism, for example. Or again, that very kind of long tradition of, or very long imaginary tradition, I should say, of kind of anti-Westernism, where the West and who is the West changes, of course, from, I don't know, the Teutonic Knights in the 12th century to Sweden in the 17th or 18th, to, I don't know, Napoleon, to Germany, to what have you. And so this always this West, meddling and Russia imagine as a kind of as a keeper of tradition. Right, that capital T tradition, as a keeper of conservative politics and conservative ideas, as opposed to the West that's imagined as an antithesis of tradition, as being too liberal, too progressive, too kind of, you know, hostile in the overall towards Russia. And of course, there's that imperial mission that in some ways Russia has always been expanding. And in this, I think the 19th century historiography is particularly important, because in the 19th century, there's a series of Russian historians. Vasily Kluchevsky is probably the most important of them, who create this idea that Russia has always been an empire, and it's just how Russia is, and it's always meant to be expanding, and it's always meant to be subjugating its weaker neighbors. And if it stops, kind of like a shark, you know, if it stops, it drowns, right? If Russia stops doing that, then something bad will happen to it. And I think that idea is that normalizes conquest, normalizes imperialism, is very much part of contemporary ideology. But I think what's also really interesting is that you see a kind of again, right? But there's all these other things that are happening in Russian history that get, you know, again, because they don't fit these main themes, they get kind of dropped, right? So for example, Lenin, right? Like, even though Lenin is still on the Red Square in the mausoleum, or his body is, you know, he's kind of viewed as maybe not the hero, right? But Stalin is viewed as a kind of true Russian sort of leader.
Strongman.
I'm sorry? As a strongman.
I mean, in addition to the themes that you laid out, and you laid them out wonderfully in the book, but there's also this emphasis on the great leader.
Yes.
Right? So you're looking at the Middle Ages and you're sort of picking out people who stand in for the current great leader. I mean, is it, whether it's Nevsky or Stalin or whatever. And Lenin is not exactly like that mold of person. I think it would be a different kind of regime that would turn to him. Anyway, by the way, because I mentioned Erdogan and Turkey, I should also mention Greece, obviously. And if anyone is interested in seeing this depicted visually, the opening ceremony of the 2004 Olympics in Athens is such a wonderful demonstration of this, where you're just like, you know, pagans and Christians and ancients and moderns and Democrats and imperialists, all just kind of part of the same, you know, the same story.
A rich tapestry, right? With all these different strands.
Yes. I mean, you know, being on the Aegean and the Mediterranean, it all has a different kind of style to it. But, you know, be that as it may. So, we've got this thousand-year history that Russia is, you know, as everyone else, sort of picking and choosing what to emphasize and what not. So let's talk about the connections to Byzantium specifically. And maybe we can start off by, could you tell us about the connections to Byzantium that were being postulated or forged or whatever before the mid 19th century in Russia?
Yes, and again, I think a lot of it is that a lot of that kind of work of making these connections comes before the 19th century, but it comes in a very particular context, because starting around kind of late 15th century, which of course is after the Byzantine Empire has already ended, we see this really interesting moment where the Grand Principality of Moscow is starting to assert more power over its neighbors. It gets kind of more away from its previous sort of client status of in the Golden Horde, and it tries to assert some kind of again, this a glorious, you know, past, or some kind of past for itself, especially the kind of past that would maybe get European rulers to view this new principality with more respect and kind of pay more attention to it. And of course, connecting itself to the Byzantine Empire made some amount of sense strategically. And so, for example, we see that the rulers of Moscow, such as Grand Prince Ivan III, and then his grandson Ivan IV, better known as Ivan the Terrible, they keep making these claims to Moscow's and Rus' connection to the Byzantine Empire. For instance, Ivan III famously marries Zoe Palaiologa, the niece of the last Byzantine emperor, who at that point is a kind of refugee, high status refugee in Italy. But a lot of this is not so much as, we want to be the Byzantines, or we want to have this really kind of firm connection to the to the Byzantine Empire. After all, the empire was already gone, but rather, again, to create an image of Moscow as a respectable and kind of powerful state. We see the same thing happening with the two-headed eagle, which is, again, is often imagined, Russia took the eagle from the Byzantines because they imagined themselves as the heirs to the Byzantine Empire. But actually, we see that, again, Ivan III adopts this two-headed eagle, not so much from the Byzantines or because of the Byzantines, but rather because he's trying to deal during this time. This is very late 15th century. He's trying to deal with the Holy Roman Emperor. He's trying to have his daughter marry the son, the heir of the Holy Roman Empire. He needs to raise his prestige. And so he starts to use the two-headed eagle. Of course, the Holy Roman Emperor is also using a two-headed eagle. And so it creates this idea of parity and kind of, equality between the two. So it's again, it's in ironically, if much later in Russia, the Byzantine Empire is often invoked to stress the kind of difference between Russia and the rest of Europe. In this case, the Byzantium was like a gateway into being accepted in Europe. And of course, we also see some clerical authors, although again, in a very kind of touch and go way, that might invoke the Byzantine Empire, might invoke Rome in their writings. But I think it's very important, and we, I think, as medievalists know this, to look at the context, right? Like if someone says, someone compares, a Russian prince or Prince of Moscow as, to Constantine or something like that, that doesn't necessarily mean that they think that, Moscow is the heir of Rome. They're making other claims. They're making perhaps claims having to do, again, specifically with religion rather than politics per se. But also on the other hand, we see Russian rulers being critical of Byzantium, since again, after all, it did fall, right? So one political thinker during the reign of Ivan IV says, well, maybe Russia should actually, if they want to imitate someone, they should probably imitate the Ottomans, since the Ottomans at that point were ascending and a much more powerful empire. So again, I think a lot of these connections get they're made, or these claims are made with specific purposes in mind at the time, and then get blown out of proportion or misinterpreted much later in the 19th century. And then, of course, we have the Greek project, which is its own beast.
Before we talk about that, I just wanted to sort of weigh in a little bit with my own views about what you were just describing, and maybe just to kind of put my own cards on the table here, and you don't have to agree with this, but it's something that I've been looking into recently. And let me just say, I am not persuaded that like early imperial Russia before the late 19th century, that there's any serious identification with the history of the Byzantine Empire or sense of continuity or anything like that. And all of the things that you discuss are, in fact, make much more sense if seen as actual imitations of Western European practice. In other words, connections to Constantine are pervasive in Western European thought, political, dynastic, Christian, whatever, at this time. Also, tracing your dynasty back to some Byzantine dynasty. Ditto can be done for many Western kings and monarchs. The eagle imagery you talked about, it's not from Byzantium, it's from Western Europe. The whole idea of the Third Rome, that I think it's more of an internet talking point these days than it ever was, like at a sort of weighty, ideological import in the 17th century. I simply see no effort to make it real. And by the way, so I was looking about the history of the early history of Moscow, and there doesn't seem to be any attempt to make it look like Rome or Constantinople. Instead, the symbolism, to the degree that they borrow any, is Jerusalem. And so that the ceremonies and everything is meant to recreate Jerusalem. I think that the Third Rome idea, weak and marginal though it was, is I think more intended to refer to Orthodox continuity. And to on that point, yes, like there was definitely a genealogical trajectory that was traced from Constantinople to Muscovy and Russia, except I keep finding that in the process they're disparaging Constantinople. And I think it's because of the union, right? So the idea in Russia is not that, oh, we're continuing the great tradition of Orthodoxy from the Byzantines and we are their heirs, but rather that the Byzantines betrayed it and were the true custodians of Orthodoxy because they went with the West. And it's not until like the late 19th century that that kind of changes. Anyway, sorry, I just had to have my piece because I get email, Eugene, I get email, as a Byzantist, it's like, well, what about Third Rome? And I like, oh no.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely correct. And that's something that, again, I was trying to dispel that it's always in dialogue with the West. It's always trying to kind of imitate what the West is doing. And yes, you're absolutely right. Like there's a great article that I probably will butcher the title of, but it's something like Moscow, Third Rome.
What does Third Rome have to say about Second Rome? Is this Sergei
or something like that, or like, well, no, that one is great, right? Yes. And actually, Sergei Ivanov is wonderful. And I think you had him on your podcast at some point. Again, unfortunately, I think he had to leave Russia shortly after the invasion.
Yes.
There's also making allusions to Kiev. Kiev, for example, right? It has the Golden Gate, right? But there's all this, mm-hmm. there's actually much more allusions to Constantinople in
exactly.
Kiev than in Moscow.
Paintings of the Hippodrome and Hagia Sophia and things like that. Yes, definitely.
Yes, exactly. Right. And the Sophia Church, right? In Kiev, in Novgorod, right? And also Novgorod, right? There is that famous tale of the white cowl, which is the white cowl that the patriarch wears, that supposedly, right, like it's kind of like the donation of Constantine legend with an addition, right, that basically the cowl goes from Rome to Constantinople and then it like mystically is transferred to Novgorod, not to Moscow, but to Novgorod. And so the Archbishop of Novgorod is actually the real, sort of spiritual heir of the Byzantine church. So yes, absolutely. And that's, I think that's part of it, is that like in the 19th century, all these allusions get blown out of proportion or kind of, twisted to align with the then imperial ideology, not as they were back in the, 16th or 17th century.
I thought we might talk about Catherine the Great's Greek project, but I realize now that might take a bit too much time. And fascinating though it is, it's such a weird idiosyncratic thing that it doesn't lead us to the next topic, which is where I want to go, which is like right now, can you tell us some like current theories that attempt to link Russia to Byzantium? And you talked about a documentary or a film that was, and that has lessons like what lessons are Russians or Russian authorities trying to draw from the history of Byzantium?
Yeah, so this was a documentary, and I think that's kind of the start in some ways, because for most of the time, like I remember growing up, I mean, you would hear about the Byzantine Empire, of course, like in history books or whatever, but it wasn't really these allusions weren't really necessarily made until the early 2000s again. And this is important, that important kind of watershed moment where Putin, after his 2 terms in office, is holding this kind of sham election, which basically elects his successor, Dmitry Medvedev, as president. And then Putin gets appointed as Medvedev's prime minister. So it's a real kind of sham spectacle, but it still required, I think, a kind of a show of power, especially since there was this idea that Medvedev was supposed to be more liberal, and so you needed to kind of show that no, like we're not doing that, like we're still staying the course. And so during that kind of few months, so the elections were, I think, in March, and the few months around that, there was a lot of different medievalisms kind of popping up. One of which was this documentary called "The Fall of an Empire: The Lesson of Byzantium," and it was written and produced by Tikhon Shevkunov, who was the well, he's this sort of cleric, right? I think he was in charge of the Ascension Monastery, I think, in Moscow. I'm trying to remember correctly, but at the time, but he was also rumored to be very close to Putin. Some said that he's Putin's confessor.
Oh boy.
And it's still that still gets repeated. I don't know to what extent that is true, but he had the ear, I think, of Putin at the time and since. And so he created this documentary, which is wildly ahistorical. It for the most part kind of ignores or jumbles actual Byzantine history and does that in favor of claiming these kind of parallels between Byzantium and contemporary Russia. And again, we see the sort of repetition of those same themes that I've mentioned earlier, that all problems in Byzantium and in Russia come from the meddling West, that Byzantium and Russia need to rally around a strong autocratic ruler. For example, Shevkunov points to Basil II, the Bulgar Slayer, as the kind of Putin again that idea of like Putins in the past, right? Like these sort of like Putin-like rulers in the past. And so Basil is viewed as the worthy ruler to imitate, and then his successor is viewed as somewhere weaker, and so it kind of again mimics this worry that what if the Putin's successor is not as autocratic as Putin himself. But there are also homophobic and anti-Semitic allusions in the documentary. It's pretty awful. But what's really interesting, of course, it was very critically received by scholars. Again, we've mentioned Sergei Ivanov, who I think written a few review articles of it, and other Byzantinists, professional Byzantinists, I think were quite unhappy with it for very good reasons. But even some in the church, so then Patriarch Alexei II, who died later that year, sort of scolded lightly Shevkunov for basically bringing too much of present into the past and kind of trying to maybe make these allusions too on the nose. Which, I mean, if you're a priest, and you get scolded by the patriarch, that's a pretty big deal. You'd think that would be a kind of a quiet down and go away kind of moment. But no, but the next patriarch is very much in favor, and Shevkunov, I think, in some ways, I think, is being kind of prepared, maybe, as if like the current patriarch Kirill dies. I think I might be wrong, but I think Shevkunov might be his successor. He's certainly the most well-known figure in the church after Kirill, I think, in terms of publicity, in terms of being kind of everywhere. And again, in terms of his proximity to political power. This documentary was, on the other hand, very popular in the government, in the military, in the security services. They saw it as kind of, prescription for what needs to be done. And again, it came out just as Russia was starting to kind of re-embrace a lot of these anti-Westernism, anti-imperialism. It invaded Georgia that same year. And also what's very important is that kind of on the heels of that, since the early 2010s, we see there is a TV station, which now is kind of like a multimedia website where it doesn't broadcast, but you can still see things online, called Tsargrad TV. And Tsargrad, of course, is a Russian kind of outdated name for Constantinople, right? Tsar City. That TV station, in its kind of ideological statement, points out that Moscow is the third Rome. It's also bankrolled by Konstantin Malafeyev, who is this ultra-conservative Russian businessman with ties to Kremlin and to Putin. So there is a lot of these very interesting ways in which, the church, or at least parts of the Russian Orthodox Church Kremlin, are very interested in, again, using these very tired in some ways connections or kind of forced connections to Byzantium, but again to pretty much reinforce the same messages as they've always done.
So I was reading your account of this documentary or the whole approach to the Russian approach to Byzantine history as one from which you learn lessons. I was struck by the structural parallel between that and the way in which the fall of the Roman Empire is talked about in the West, much more pervasively and with, tremendous anxiety, still 1500 years after the event itself, where you blame it on whatever, like the lessons are too many sex orgies or too much immigration or whatever. And you always use that to like, we got to crack down on the things that we're, because we are Rome.
Right.
This is the implicit assumption. We are Rome. And so we got to avoid doing what the Romans did to, quote, fall. And I thought it was oddly similar to that. It's like, yeah, the Byzantines were great and we are them, but they fell and we have to avoid what they did.
Yes, exactly. And that's precisely the message. And I think in some ways, at least maybe to Shevkunov and to some people in who are kind of interested in that. It's important to remember that like Putin styles himself as a kind of a history buff. And I think a lot of that is informed by his interests or interests of whoever advises him. And yes, exactly. So I think like the fall of Constantinople is like the fall of Rome in the West, right? And like in America, right? Especially, I think there's a obsession with it. But because we imagine ourselves the new Rome, right? And Russia imagines itself kind of the new Byzantium, essentially. And of course, both are wrong and both are ahistorical, but there we go. I mean, they're still powerful.
But at least Washington, D.C. is actually architecturally modeled on Rome.
Like, yes, no, that's fair enough.
Deliberately. So we're now going to go a little bit down this sort of theological rabbit hole, which is, because I get email, Eugene, as I said. I'll tell you later. So what is the theory of the katechon, and what role does it play in Russian imperial ideology?
So katechon is itself a very interesting concept. It comes from, or it's used in Paul's letters to, I think, Thessalonians. And in that context, it means a kind of something that restrains the coming of the apocalypse or the coming of Antichrist or what have you. But it's very vague, right? Which, of course, makes like these vague allusions are always really useful to whoever is trying to use them in the present. But it in particular, I think in the 20th century, it gained currency with Carl Schmitt, who was a German sort of early 20th century German political theorist, member of the Nazi Party, who kind of imagined Katehan as a essentially the state that is so imbued with a traditional Christian sort of values, what we might call, I guess, Christian nationalism, perhaps, that it would then enforce these traditional values onto the population, and everything is done in accordance to this traditional Christianity. So essentially the melding kind of church and state together. In Russia, the main proponent of this is Alexander Dugin. And Dugin is, I think, of all these Russian ideologues, I feel like he's probably the most famous in the West, in part because of his own kind of self-promotion, but also because I think a lot of far-right groups either kind of have relations with him or network with him, or perhaps, you know, his books have been published and translated into English. But for Dugin, of course, it's sort of that same idea. He uses Schmitt's idea of Katahan. But of course, for him, it's like Russia is or should be the, you know, Katahan, right? So, you know, Russia should enforce all these Christian ideas. It's the bulwark against the modernity. To him, modernity is that kind of coming of the apocalypse or what have you. And it's a very esoteric idea, right? Like most people in Russia don't read Dugin. He's very hard to read. He's not a good writer. He's very kind of esoteric. But, you know, he tries to promote it. There are all kinds of, he gets interviews, and there's a website, kind of media website called katahan.ru, which is also sponsored by Malafeyev. So it's kind of like, you know, a more esoteric branch of Tsargrad TV. So there is attempts to promote this idea. And it's also important to remember, like Dugin, some news, I think New York Times dubbed him like, you know, Putin's Rasputin or something like that, right? Like this kind of, you know, like secret, you know, person mm-hmm. whispers in the ear of the leader. But he doesn't have a lot of direct power, I think, in Russia, politically speaking. But it's important to remember that many kind of modern far-right movements use metapolitics, right? So they use this kind of decentralized power. They try to influence the discourse. They try to influence like national conversations. They try to normalize ideas. And that would make it easier for whoever is in power to put these mm-hmm. ideas kind of through. And so in that respect, I think Dugin is has some influence. But it's also important to remember that esoteric as it is, in some ways, Katahan appeals to Russian belief in Russia's special mission just in general, right? There's a sense of exceptionalism that, again, often is viewed through the lens of like the Soviet Union's defeat of Nazi Germany, which, of course, Russia has kind of appropriated and claimed exclusively for itself. Like if you're studying World War II in Russia as a like a school pupil, good luck learning anything about you know, what else was happening during World War II except for the Eastern Front. And I don't want to like minimize you know, of course, the contribution of the Soviet Union in this, but it's important to remember that like it gets kind of twisted again out of proportion. And in general, like there is like the celebrations of that sort of you know, Russian or well Soviet, but like reappropriated as Russian victory in the last few decades have been just really kind of just tasteless and kind of so like just like yeah. shocking over the top that it's really disturbing. But yeah, so it's an esoteric claim, but I think it fits what people already kind of believe about Russia. So I think it's easier for that claim to gain some currency with enough, you know, publicity and whatnot.
Yeah, in my experience, the Katahan theory is a combination of conspiracy theory on the one hand, and because behind it, at least in the versions that I've come across, there is a conspiracy of, you know, evil people. Whether they're Westerners in some traditions or Jews or liberals or whatever, to bring about the apocalypse or support right. the Antichrist, who's out there plotting whatever, you know, Soros or whoever, right? And so on the one hand, and on the other hand, there's the this nation of destiny, right, that has to remain pure in order to resist those conspiracies. And the idea is that God will hold off the end of the world so long as this champion nation is resisting the forces of evil, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. That's very much. And again, so from Dugin's perspective, it's definitely that nation or that withholder is definitely Russia. And that's why, right, like Russia has to embrace, because he doesn't necessarily, and then there are other people like him who don't necessarily agree with everything Russia is doing right now. Like for him, I think Russia's invasion of Ukraine was this moment where like, finally, you know, we're embracing our, you know, destiny or whatever. And I think, because he tends to see war in this very, well, like fascists do, right? In this sort of self-purifying, that Russia will purify itself in this cataclysm of the war and rise from the ashes. So I think, yeah, for him, it's like, you know, this is what Russia should be, right? It's not always is, but that's what it should be. And then once it is that, then, you know, we'll have this kind of, you know, we'll be the last, you know, the last line between like the end of the world and ourselves.
Yes. Because I guess that some of the email that I get is like, well, in your history of Byzantium, you don't say whether it was the Katechon. And I'm like, I don't know. I never came across that in my sources. Okay. We're out of time. I would have liked to talk about the Crimea, which you talk about in your book a lot, and the Russian annexation of the Crimea in 2014 was also propped up with a whole, you know, cartful of medievalisms, many cartfuls of medievalisms that you talk about. So readers, interested members of the audience can go read the book where you talk about that. I wanted to ask you a final question about the subtitle of your book, which is The Contest for Imaginary Past. So who are the contestants? I mean, who do you imagine as the interlocutor or imagined interlocutor of these appropriations?
So I think, I mean, there might be several interpretations of this, you know, much like the Katehan, you know, it's being purposefully vague there. No, but I'm just kidding. But yeah, I think to me, the way that I see this subtitle is that, again, despite the claims of continuity or the idea that Russian history, you know, moves in circles or that there is like a rise and fall all the time, I think in the book I try to show that, you know, these same themes or same examples of medievalisms acquire new, different, very often conflicting and kind of competing meanings based on historical context. And so in my mind, the contests, right, I think it's plural in the title, are between the meanings and their past and present uses, and the way that actually, like, again, if you zoom out and look at this narrative as it's being presented by, you know, official Russian propaganda, it all seems kind of smooth and seamless. But actually, I think what's very important is to kind of destabilize it you know, pay attention to, like, where things are coming from, what is their history. That's why I decided, not, instead of just focusing on Russia in the present, to look at these deeper roots, right, like 18th century, 19th century, because I think a lot of by looking at those roots, you can see how these meanings and these kind of continuities, I think, come out as less smooth and less real and seem more artificial.
That's roughly what I took it to be. And in the back of my mind is always like the main contestant, Eugene, is us.
Right.
Right. Like professional historians who are not, you know, funded by Gazprom or whatever. Like we have our little jobs and our little offices and we have our sources and we have our training and we're trying to do right by, you know, history. And it's such an amazingly unequal struggle, right? When you have such massively powerful institutions that have an interest in history being whatever they want it to be, I find it amazing and also a source of optimism that we have institutions that are capable of pushing back against that to some degree. So I see it as a very important, mission. Kudos to countries that sponsor that. And they're not all doing a very good job of it at present. Anyway, I'll stop there. But I take your book to be, as a contribution to that whole overall contest. So thank you for that.
Yeah, and I hope that this continues, right? This topic gets more attention. I think there's another book that came out just a few months before mine, I think called Putin's Dark Ages by Dina Kapayeva, that I think I haven't read it yet, but it looks like it's focusing more on the present day, but it still looks at these kind of allusions to the past, to the medieval past, in the present, and I hope that this topic will continue getting attention. I know there is a lot of wonderful work being done just in general in the field of medievalism studies in Eastern Europe, as well countries like Hungary that have some of the same problems of history being marshaled to support whatever present day ideologies they have. And again, I thank you for having me. Thank you for helping to get these messages out to broader audience.
Thank you, Eugene, and thanks for coming on to the podcast.